My name's Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Is this a vote, a group conscience? I mean, can you hear me all right back there? Oh, good. I tell you, you people are going to have to lighten up and have a little fun. You're just a little too serious, you know? Always heard of these hotbeds of enthusiasm. Well, I never knew it was Sacramento, California, but damn, you people really lay it back and fly. I got to commend you on it. It's really neat. Daryl, thank you. That's outstanding. Much glad. Laura, thanks for asking me to come, and all the people responsible for asking me to come. It's really a joy to be out here. Thanks for the fruit basket. I'm really serious. I do like fruit baskets. I don't always eat all the fruit, but I carry it home. It's a real privilege and pleasure to be here. God always seems to bless me. I'm not unique because He's also blessed everybody in this room, and many of you are more aware of it, or a lot of you are more aware of it than others. But I got picked up at the airport by someone that Laura had sent, and it really was kind of a last-minute kind of arrangement. And, you know, there are moments, at least for me, there have been moments frozen in my life when they're highly significant. And I spent about 2 hours with a man that shared with me, and I shared with him. We got about the same length of sobriety. We've traveled very much the same road, and we are currently at the same spot of going to a different plateau spiritually, and I'm real grateful for that. I think this will be a moment that will be frozen in my mind. The speakers have been outstanding. About 2 years ago, I started listening. I finally concluded that I started listening because for the last 2 years, I've heard an awful lot of good speakers. Now, I can't believe the first 15 years of my sobriety, there were a whole bunch of lousy speakers, you know? I'm reminded of a guy from West Texas who said one time that he found it interesting that he'd fly all the way across the country to give an AA talk, but he wouldn't walk across the street to listen. And I found myself falling into that same category, and now I'm beginning to listen much better, and I'm hearing some outstanding stuff. And this has been really outstanding. Brian, last night, talking about the dignity, which I'll talk about in more detail, the dignity of recovery. And Larry talking about the respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a real critical issue. Each of them said a whole lot more, but I'm really, really in tune with the idea of showing respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, because little by little we are going to be challenged on that. And more we are finding that there is less respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think it's intentional. I have my own personal ideas of why that's true, but I was really grateful to hear him talk about the respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that respect for me begins on an individual basis and ends up being a collective respect. I listened to the Al-Anon speaker this afternoon, and it's the first time I've heard an Al-Anon speaker give my story without alcohol. You know? My first thought was, like it always is, what we need to do is take her out in the woods and get her drunk for about 2 weeks and bring her into the right program. But then I finally realized that the commonality of the spirit most of the time are the feelings for which there's only one solution for those of us who stick around, and that's the spiritual solution for those feelings. And she talked about a lot of the things that I have to deal with on a daily basis. I don't even know that I spell it lust, but it seems to come out that way. I can fall in love with a mirror about 15 minutes and have to be careful to wear my clothes or I might get married, you know. With a room of this, and I'm looking forward to hearing Mildred tomorrow, and all the speakers have given the short vignettes. I used to wonder, first time I ever came out to California, I thought, my God, they're going to have more speakers than we got time. But I've come to really enjoy y'all's format of having a lot of speakers, a lot of short, capsulized speakers, and they've been exceptionally good. And I really mean that. This is not an obsequious, patronizing type of deal. I'm telling you, that's exactly what it is. I've gotten too damned old for that. In a room that's this charged and this energetic, sometimes I get so fired up into life. You know, all of us are kind of like hyperactive children, only we come in to be hyperactive adults, and I get so fired up in that enthusiasm sometimes that my memory just kind of goes, boom, that's it, you know? And I'm reminded of this story about this old priest who was about 95 years old, and He still, his mind was just razor sharp. I mean, he could remember anything except names. So what he had done is figure out a way to remember names. He'd write them down on the inside lapel of his coat. And so they asked him to give this retirement dinner for one of his proteges who was now 65 or 70 years old and who was retiring. So they asked him to give the retirement talk. So he got up behind the podium and he said, "I'm deeply grateful to be here for this retirement dinner for my protege for lo these many years, this man who has become my good friend, Father James O'Reilly. Most of all, I'm grateful for the years that Father has served in this wonderful parish, my favorite parish, the parish of St. Michael. But most of all, I'm really grateful for Father's years of laboring long and hard in the vineyards of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ." So if about halfway through this talk, and I'm telling you, it happens. If I go down and go, "Jesus Christ," you know I've just forgotten where I was. You know? There have been times I walked off of the, I just forgot where I was. There have been times I just take off and tell my brother's story. He's been in AA for 12 years. We've got the same parents. Hell, the same deal. I don't see a hell of a lot of difference in it, one way or another. I was listening to a tape about a month ago, and this tape was Bill Wilson's talk that he gave on the night that Dr. Bob died. That was in 1950. The quality of the tape was not good. I was a little bit surprised at the Vermont accent because I'd really never heard Bill Wilson, and obviously he would talk that way. And he started off that talk by saying, the day that Dr. Bob died, he said, "I did not want to come to this meeting," but he said, "Lois told me to come and to give Dr. Bob's talk." He said, "I want to read you a telegram," and he opened the telegram. It was from Smitty, and some of us have been fortunate enough to meet Smitty, who was Dr. Bob's son. And I sat and talked with Smitty one time at a conference, and he said, "Daddy told me that God knew exactly what he was doing when he put Bill and me together, because," he said, "we never argued." He said he also knew what he was doing when he put us together, because he said, "if he'd have given me," Dr. Bob said, "if he'd have given me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it'd probably still be in Akron. But if he'd given it to Bill, he would have franchised it." So he knew exactly what he was doing. And as he opened this telegram, he said, it started off, said, "Dear Uncle Bill, Daddy passed away today. Tell Aunt Lois we love her. Smitty." As I listened to that tape, what I was consumed with was the gratitude of those people who laid it on the line and bled back when there wasn't a directory. Back when there wasn't, like there is in Louisville, 400 meetings a week. Back when there wasn't a time that he could pick up the telephone and call his sponsor and talk to him. All the things that I have a tendency to take for granted, because God knew and gave the direction to two men to begin a journey that enables us to be here tonight. And I feel deeply grateful for that. I also feel deeply responsible to see that that message that they started from such a sparse beginning continues to remain pure in its delivery. Bill Wilson, in his last talk, and you can see it on many of the Alano clubs and AA clubs, whatever you want to call them, on the wall, there was Dr. Bob's last talk and there was Bill's last talk. Bill's last talk, he actually didn't give because he was too sick to give it. Was written in the fall of 1970, and as many of you know, he died in January of 1971. And in that talk, he stressed two points. One point was that he had come to know that anonymity was ever more critical. Each of us will work out in our own minds exactly what that means to us. And today, this afternoon, when Dick and Peggy gave the traditions, they hit hard on anonymity, and each of us will in his own way have to decide exactly what that means to us. And I hope to God we read our literature and the way it was written to know how to arrive at a proper way to deal with that. But the main thing he stressed in that talk that hit me was he said AA must and will change. See, that's pretty shaky for me to say AA must and will change. And what does it mean? And all I can tell you are the last 17 years as I've reflected on it. The first change that I've seen has been the women and the children. Even 17 years ago, there was not these many women. If we had a meeting, there might be two women in the meeting, and there were no children. The children began to come to meetings that we had in Louisville about 1979. I'm talking about children. 14, 15, and 16 years old. And they came, and there was a cadre of them of about 20. And they began to come to all the meetings that we went to. The main reason they came to the meetings that we went to is because nobody else wanted them. They said they were just a pain in the ass. And they were a pain in the ass. But I quickly began to realize that they were the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've got a son that came in this program when he was 15 years old. I actually revere this. When I talk to an old timer of 35 and 40 and 45 and 50 years of sobriety, I love to hear them tell me the stuff that's in the white lines on the pages. The black lines are written, but they tell me the history that's never been recorded and the things that went on that were so personal. I really revere that. And we're talking about people with 35 to 50 years of sobriety. We're going to have people in this program in the next 20 and 25 years that'll have 70 and 75 years of sobriety. And our job, at least I see it, certainly I am more than aware of my responsibility to see that they get the message that was begun in 1935. And I think that's real critical. Yeah, I know AA will be on this earth as long as God wants it to be. I'm really aware of that. But I also hear God say, you have a responsibility, Vern. See, I really believe that God can feed me, but I know He's given me a knife and a fork and a plate and the ability to raise the food. And I feel strongly that you, as I look around this room, you young people need to hear exactly what AA was intended to be. I asked Geraldine Delaney, who's been sober now about 50 years, she's 80-something years old, and I said, Miss Delaney, I said, has AA changed since you came in? She said, wow. Yes, it has, just like that. I said, how's it changed? And she said, when I came in the program, she said, there were probably 20 old-timers for every newcomer. She said, today there are probably 20 or 30 newcomers for every old-timer. She said, we've got people with 1, 2, and 3 years of sobriety sponsoring newcomers. I said, is that bad? And she said, I don't know whether it's bad or good. It's just a fact. I said, what's the message? And she says, the message is those of us who have been around for a while need to be real sure that those principles are being passed on in their simplicity and in their profundity and consistently. What I've come to know, at least in our community, is the best way to do this, at least the way we found, are big book studies. I go to 5 and 6 meetings a week, and at least 2 of those meetings are big book studies. As we become more fundamentally grounded in the big book and teach that newcomer the big book and have that sponsor that says, shut up, but let's follow the deal. Let's follow the deal. See, I lived in the first 8.5 years in this program, I lived on a 3 1/3 step program. I had the first 3 steps and a third of the 12th step. I came into AA and they said, don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. They just gave passing fancy to reading the big book. It was don't drink, go to meetings and save drunks. The reason I stayed sober for the first 8.5 years was 2 reasons. One is alcohol whipped my ass. It whipped me so bad. And it didn't work. You know, it didn't work. It would stop, as Larry said, it would stop the sweat and it would stop the diarrhea, but it didn't stop the committee. It didn't work. And the other thing that kept me sober was I spent almost every day working with new people. Hell, I'd go down into the men's shelter. I'd go to the prison. I'd get people and take them to meetings. They got the kid and they said, if somebody ain't drinking, Burns Brady will give them a beer and take them to treatment. What I found out was, as this was going along, some of these people that I'd gone and gotten and got into treatment or got into AA made more sense than I did. I got goofy as a snake. 8.5 years in this program, I was goofy. I mean, everything raging in me. Didn't even come close to taking a drink, but there have been a lot of people that thought maybe I ought to take a drink or shoot myself because I was really goofy. Driven by all of these circumstances, 8.5 years in this program, I became a student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came to live a 12-step program. And there are always people coming to me today and say, I can't seem to get it. I think I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And when I sit down and go over that program with them, what they've got is a 3 1/3 step program or a 2 1/3 step program. And what I'm going to tell you is I've lived that 3 1/3 step. I've lived that 12-step program, and it's as different as daylight and dark. If you want the whole deal, you got to get off your ass and do the whole deal. And if anybody's saying, I don't know why I'm not happy, joyous, and free, well, it may be because you're a worm. You know, I don't know. Or maybe because you ain't doing the deal. But if my experience means anything, if you want the full payoff, You got to do the full deal. And if nobody's ever said it to you, and I know they have this weekend, but maybe you didn't hear them say it, I want to be sure that I say it so that everybody can hear it once more. There's somebody on this podium saying, if you want the whole deal, you got to do the whole deal. Now, as I became a student of this big book, I found some interesting things. There was a consistency of this presentation that everything that preceded the drink was this peculiar mental twist. Peculiar mental twist. I'm going to tell you a story that will tell you what I think the peculiar mental twist is in the alcoholic. There's this old fellow that was a traveling salesman down in East Texas. And he used to travel, and I heard this story at a talk I gave down in Texas, and the guy that was the voice of the conference was about, 80-something years old, been sober about 50 years. He talked like he had a flat brainwave. But if you listen to this guy, he was really funny. And he told this wonderful story. And this is the peculiar mental twist of the alcoholic. This fellow was a traveling salesman in East Texas. He'd go from town to town to town, spend a week in one town, then a week in the next town. And like in West Kentucky, where I was born and raised, he was what we call bad to drink. So he'd check into a motel and get drunk that night, and they'd always set him up with the same deal, and the next night the same thing. So one night he'd had about this skunk story that you were telling. He'd had all this fun he could tolerate, you know. So he went to AA. Came back on the circuit the next time around, checked into this motel, and went out that night to go to an AA meeting. They thought he was going out to get drunk again, so they set him up like they'd always set him up. He came back in, switched on the light. Sure enough, there it was. They had a fifth of whiskey and a thing of ice sitting beside the bed, and on the foot of the bed sat these two beautiful women. He sat there and looked at that scene for a minute, and he said, well, he said, you know, I've gone to AA, and I've asked them what I got to do to stay sober and be happy. He said, they told me that I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. See, I can relate to that story. Every drunk in this room can relate to that story. I told this story at a conference I spoke at about 2 weeks ago, and after it was over, one young lady came to me, and she was mad as hell, and she said, that was a chauvinistic joke. And I said, yes, honey, it sure was a chauvinistic joke, because hopefully if we stay in this program long enough, at least as males, we'll quit being chauvinistic. But every one of us coming in are, and that's just the way it is. We don't know how to deal with women, you know? That's part of the peculiar mental twist. We're going to always try to break the rules. You know, parking handicap parking zone. Drive 75 miles an hour, 65 mile an hour speed limit because the rules are written for somebody. Screw the IRS because I got to get to them before they get to me. It's a peculiar mental twist. Silkworth said these are rules. And every alcoholic wants to break the rules because they were made for somebody else. It's what I call the delusion of immunity. The delusion of immunity. You know, if this program were just only drinking, then I could take every one of you, put you in a 28-day detox, bring you out, and you'd be cured. This program sure is about drinking in that we've got this physical allergy. And I got to tell you, if anybody in here thinks that if they're an alcoholic of my type, thinks that they can drink like a normal person, you're not going to do it. Because where alcohol is concerned, we're playing two sandwiches short of a picnic. And we always will be. But if that were the whole deal, then it would be a simple problem. Now, this whole deal is a disease of thinking. And when we stop the drinking, if we don't deal with the thinking, we go back to the drinking. You know, my biggest problem is when I get to thinking, somewhere along the line, I begin to believe what I'm thinking. And the whole deal is there. This peculiar mental twist. I said to my sponsor about 3 years ago, I said, so-and-so had a slip last night. And he said, no, they didn't. He said, they drank last night. He said, they had a slip about 6 months ago. Whether it's stopping meetings, whether it's the peculiar mental twist, whether it's not, I think I can take care of two women rather than one. One of them happens to be my wife, and the other's not going to be my wife, but if they don't know about each other, hell, I can do it because I believe in God, and I'm going to a lot of meetings, right? And I'm not preaching and being judgmental, because that's exactly the way it appeared to me about 7 years ago. It was a normal thing. I just happened to be in love with two women. I was blessed, right? And being a man of pure spirit and spiritual direction, I could be able to take care of both of those women so long as they were on opposite sides of the town. And
I believe that shit. You know, Daryl says he talks shit. I believe it. See, everybody here's laughing because you can relate to it. Break the rules. Bend the rules. Delusion of immunity. You know, as I looked at what have I got to do to deal with that peculiar mental twist, that condition of the mind, that series of thinkings that precedes the drinking. As I look at my experience, what it means is a change. This whole program is about change. This whole program is about change. Changing of an attitude. The changing of an attitude. If there's one thing that's been constant in my whole recovery process, one thing that has not changed is that I'm constantly changing. I'm not the same person today that I was when I walked in this room. I'm not the same person today that I was 2 months ago. I'm not even thinking the same way. Insights have occurred. People say these must be plateaus of growth. I can relate to that intellectually. What I relate to in my gut is these have been different plateaus of surrender. Different plateaus of surrender, and that's exactly what they've been. The surrender as I hit the wall, the surrender, and finally more surrender today because I'm following the principles and I'm finding a depth of spirituality that I never knew that I could experience. You know, I've always had this ability to surrender when I hit a wall. Wah! 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 I stand there and think, my God, why do I keep hitting this wall? You know? And then I realize, hey, I'm going to either have to walk around this SOB or I'm going to keep getting my nose bloody. You know, and I began to change. Plateaus. When I walked in this program, I surrendered to my powerlessness over alcohol. Next thing is, I surrendered to going to treatment where they sent me. I surrendered to doing the what I was told. I surrendered to getting a sponsor. I surrendered to getting a home group. I surrendered to going to AA meetings. I surrendered to reading the book. I surrendered to working the steps. I didn't just comply with them. Compliance means I'll do what you say, but I don't think it's necessary. No, I surrendered because I did what I was told because I knew damn well it was necessary, and I just prayed to God that it would work. I surrendered to those things, and the change did occur. And the change did occur and continues to occur. I'm 58 years old. I've been sober 17 years. And for the first time in my life, I feel like a grown-up. And that's incredible. Not perfect, but a grown-up. Able to live with my warts and to be able to live with your warts. That was the toughie. That was the toughie. I grew up in a little town in West Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail, and my mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. My mother dragged the whole disease of alcoholism into our home, and she never took a drink. If you read the big book in the family afterward, it said if you're around an alcoholic, raised around an alcoholic, you get neurotic. Well, my mother was goofy. My mother's one of the neatest people I've ever known in my life, but she was goofy. And the reason she was goofy is because she never had a chance to deal with all that rage and all that shame and all that guilt. She was a true adult child of an alcoholic. Now, I'm not going to get into an issue of whether they exist or not. I just know if you're raised around an alcoholic or live with an alcoholic, you just get goofy. And mother was goofy. Full of love and neatness, but boy, she was really goofy. And the way it came out was, is when we were perfect, my brother and I were perfect, mother would talk to us. If we weren't perfect, mother wouldn't talk to us. So I solved that problem real quickly. I became perfect. And I was like Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. I was the kind of kid, if you ever had a kid, you'd say, I want him to be just like Burns Brady, you know? Hell, when I was a teenager, I used to think, if I ever have a kid, I want him to be just like me. Because I really was a neat kid. I really was a neat kid. When I was in treatment, I'd been in treatment for about 2.5 months, and it was time to come home. Treatment people didn't think so, but I knew it was time to come home. I called the person in Louisville who'd sent me to treatment. I said, David, I'm going home. He said, I'm coming home. He said, that's okay. People in the treatment center said, Burns, we don't think you can stay sober. And I said, no, it's time to go home. The last day I was there, I was in the group therapy session and had about 30 people, and the therapist looked at me and said, Burns, I know you're going home. He said, I don't think you really ought to go. He said, you can be okay if you get home and get into AA. He said, but you really shouldn't go home because you haven't dealt with your anger. And I said, you kiss my ass. Of course I've dealt with my anger. And he looked at me and I looked at him. I thought, oh, no, I haven't dealt with my anger. He said, come out here and get in this little ring. He put a straight back chair and a straight back chair, and we were facing each other just about that far apart. And he said, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Answer them just as fast as you can. Don't worry about the answer. Just answer them. He said, who do you hate most in your whole life? And I said, I hate my mother's guts. And it seemed like I was out there a week, but I was out there about 15 seconds. At the end of that series of staccato questions and answers, I ended up on my knees hugging his calves, screaming how much I loved my mother and how much I hated me. And I remember he picked me up and gave me a kiss on the cheek, and he said, go home now, you know what the problem is. When you look in the mirror, you'll be looking at the problem. And through Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll learn that that problem plus God, you're also looking at the solution. As I went to sit down in the chair, he said, tell me about your mother. And I started telling him about that home she was raised in. They also had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield, Kentucky in the middle 30s. They'd put my grandfather was the town drunk in a town of about 12,000. And they'd put my grandfather in jail when he got drunk. When he sobered up, they'd put him out on the streets in a chain gang, and he'd sweep the Mayfield City streets. He was in that chain gang about every week. And mother would walk past my grandfather as she was on her way to school, and he was in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And as I told him that story, he looked at me and said, how do you think your mother felt? And all of a sudden, I just started crying because I felt for the first time in my heart and soul the pain that my mother felt. The journey of Alcoholics Anonymous was about to begin because for the first time in my life at 41 years of age, my first thought was, dear God, my mother must have been cut in half. I wish I could help her and hold her. For the first time in my life, I began to think, what can I do for my mama, not what can she do for me? And I will promise you in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you stick in here and you do the deal, what you'll find is in your thinking of your attitude, the changing in your thinking and attitude is when you begin to say, what can I do for that newcomer? What can I do for my wife? What can I do for my children instead of what can they do for me? The whole change. Read it. The purpose we're here for is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. For the first time in my life, I found out what I was even here for was to be of service, to fit myself to be of service to God and my fellow man. People say, my God, that sounds like codependency to me. Read it. The promise right before the promises. It's never even read as a promise. The great freedom of Alcoholics Anonymous, if we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. It's not a statement of aggression. It's a statement of complete surrender on the way to fitting myself to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. If you want to know what the AA is all about, that's it. It starts off by not drinking, and it ends up by being able to hold somebody when they need to be held and looking for them. Constantly walking down the halls of this building saying, hi. I'm sure there are people when they walk past me and say, who was that fruitcake? He's always said, hi. Oh, yeah. Having a good time? Glad you're here. You hear me? What's wrong with that fruitcake, you know? And there may be some newcomers here saying, oh, can someone take a drink? Well, right now, just hang on. Because if you can keep them taking that drink, there'll be a day when you walk down that hall and you'll say, hi. Having a good time? Good to see you. I didn't have any problem with alcohol and drugs in high school and college. I had a little bit of problem in college, not a lot. I remember when I first got to college, I didn't really drink. And during the first semester for pledging, on Saturday night, we'd get to Turkey House, and we'd all get liquored up. And the college I went to had a women's campus on one side of town, men's campus on the other side of town. So we'd get all about half drunk, get on a flatbed truck, and go over to the women's campus and start serenading the girls. And every Saturday night, I'd start serenading the girls, and I'd just take off all my clothes and stand there buck naked, you know. That was my first real experience with shame. Nobody sent me flowers. There were no phone calls. I'll tell you who did notice. The dean noticed. Called me in. He said, Burns, you're an excellent student. But when you drink, you do weird things. We think you shouldn't drink. And I remember thinking, I do seem to do weird things when I drink. You know, nobody else is naked but me, right? So I quit drinking, I quit getting naked, and everything was fine. We went on from there. Now, it all started my freshman year in medical school. I entered medical school in 1958, University of Louisville. I walked in that medical school, and Dean came in the first day, and he said, there are 100 of you in this class, only 75 of you graduate. He said, there may be 100 A's, but the last 25 A's will flunk. Look at the guy next to you, because he may not be here next year. And I turned around to look at that sucker, and he was looking right back at me. And I thought, oh, my God, it's me, you know. I don't know about y'all, but I've always had this motor running in me. You know, get there, get to me, get see, get to you, Mr. Nagle, go back, see, go away. See? Big Book calls it irritable, restless, discontented. The mental health people say we have attention deficit disorder. The psychiatrists say we have extreme affective disorder. And I understand why they say that, but it's always been that motor. And that motor was just running just like this, always running, always running. 2 weeks after I'd gotten to medical school, I said, I'm going home. I'm going home. I can't do it. Can't sleep, can't eat, can't do anything. I'm just going home. About that time, a good friend of mine gave me a little capsule called amphetamine. I took that amphetamine, and that motor stopped. Just like that, that motor stopped. I found four things that'll stop my motor. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and Alcoholics Anonymous. AA works better. It just takes a little longer. And I'll tell you one thing. They never have put me in jail yet for going to an AA meeting. I got put in jail for every one of those others. I mean, I thought that $50 was a reasonable price and turned out to be a policewoman. I swear to God, I only did it one time. I know you think I did it more than one time, but I only did it one time. I only had one beer. I swear, Daddy, I only had one beer, right? First semester of my freshman year, I was number one in my class. Second semester of my freshman year, I was number 100. 2 weeks before graduation in 1962, I was kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I beat up one of my medicine professors. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Keller talked to me, and he said, Burns, what's wrong with you? And I said, I take too many drugs. And he said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, we can help you. And I said, please do. What are you going to do? And he said, we're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. If you can figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. If you figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. In other words, what he said was you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. Now, see, that's a wonderful way to live. It's called cognitive cause and effect thinking. If you don't want to get hit by a bus, don't step out in the street. If you don't want to get struck by lightning, don't walk across the golf course with one iron stuck up in the air. It's called cognitive cause and effect thinking. It works beautifully in daily living. It doesn't work at all in stopping drinking and drugging. And there are a number of reasons why. The first one is that because when we first stopped drinking and drugging, we got sawdust for brains. And that sawdust for brains lasts about 6 months to 2 years. And we literally can't think sequentially. Our biggest problem is we think we can think sequentially. And that's why Daryl's sponsor said, sit down and shut up, Daryl. Because he knew Daryl wasn't thinking. He knew he was talking, you know? And if there are people in here in that first 6 months and you think your brain is rotted, it hadn't. If you think you can think straight, you can't. But they expected me to, and this was in the early 60s, and they really felt that, you know, they didn't know this so-called prolonged recovery syndrome that Wilson talked about when he couldn't get a job for a year and a half because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. Read his story, because he's talking about what we now know as the prolonged recovery syndrome, lasts usually about 2 years. And we got sawdust for brains during that time, and that's a medical fact. But they want to have me think myself into a way of acting. Now, I'm not anti-psychiatry. Neither is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Wilson gives great credibility to Carl Jung. Great credibility. Harry Thibault was one of Wilson's confidants, and he was a psychiatrist. These people contributed greatly to Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I'm not anti-psychiatry. I'm anti-ignorance. And I practiced medicine for 25 years, and 3 years ago I quit practicing medicine to become chairman of the Impaired Physicians Committee for the state of Kentucky. My whole job today and where God has led me is teaching doctors how to treat drunks. One of the other things is to share with you, because I live with you. I've studied with them, and I practice medicine with them, but I live with you. And one of the things that God has given me the direction to do is to be sure that people in Alcoholics Anonymous who aren't doctors quit trying to practice medicine. Yeah. I stood behind a speaker stand when I was about 3 years sober and had the party line where it said, if you're taking drugs, stop! Well, There was one schizophrenic that was taking Thorazine who stopped. There was one fellow who was using Valium and had been using it for 10 years, and so he said, he's a doctor, I've got to quit taking that. So he went and stopped his Valium and flopped like a chicken for about 2 days. And his doctor called me and he said, Burns, he said, if you're going to get behind that podium, you better be damn sure you're responsible for what you say. You know? You better be damn sure that you're responsible for what you say. No, I'm not anti-psychiatry. Psychiatry helped me. Psychiatry taught me how to identify a feeling. It didn't keep me sober. It didn't keep me from taking dope. But they taught me how to identify a feeling. 15 years later, I came in with you people. And you put those feelings into a fourth step and a fifth step and brought me the spiritual solution. The spiritual solution. I see many people today ruminating in AA who have got a beautiful spiritual solution. They just don't know what the problem is. They continue to have 6 marriages in 6 years and can't figure out what the hell's wrong with their thinking. Because they're being spiritual. I swear to God, this happened. One doctor I was working with, been in AA for about 6 years, and I went up and you've been married 6 times, been divorced 6 times. I went up to him, I said, what's going on? He said, Burns, I'm being spiritual. And I said, well, okay, I have no problem with that, but what do you mean? He said, well, I married everybody I slept with. You know, and I wondered why I keep doing those same things over and over and over and over and over. Now, psychiatry helped me because it really did give me a leg up. But you had to bring me the spiritual solution to put a closure to the paragraph. And thank God I got here, and thank God you gave it to me. Thank God you gave it to me. After 2 years of psychiatric therapy, the psychiatrist said to me, well, you're ready to go back into medical school. How do you feel? And I said, well, I'm afraid. He said, why are you afraid? And I said, they're going to be watching me. He said, well, should they be watching? I said, yes, they should be watching me. He said, you whipped one of them so they should be watching you. You know they're going to be watching you, so you should be afraid. That's wonderful. Now, you know the feelings. You can own the feelings. The feelings won't have to own you, and you won't have to take dope. And I thought, God, that sounds great. Went back into medical school. Within 15 minutes, I strung out on amphetamine and just sat there and didn't know why. My classmates enabled me that year. If I got too hot, they'd take me home, put me to bed. I was married, had one small child. My wife would call the medical school, tell them I had the flu. Hell, I had the flu 25 times that year, you know. They knew better, but they'd given it their best shot, and they didn't know what else to do. I graduated, and over the next 3 years, I was at Our Lady of Peace Mental Hospital in Louisville 4 times, strapped down, IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, but I always went back to amphetamine. It always put me in a mental hospital. I went in the Army in 1967, was the officer in charge of the dispensary. So I got a break, you know, what can I say? Post commander came down, he said, Burns, are you taking the amphetamine? I said, yes, sir. And he said, if you don't quit, we'll put you in Leavenworth. So I quit. You know, once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. The message is here, I could still quit. I could still quit. Came home in 1969, got back on amphetamine, had a gallbladder attack. They took out my gallbladder, attributed partially to amphetamine. 2 members of the board of Leishner, the internist and the surgeon, came and sat beside my bed. One of those members of the board of Leishner is now dead. The other 3 are still alive and are good friends of mine. Sat beside the bed and prayed with me that I would stop taking amphetamine. Took me about 6 more months and I quit taking amphetamine in 1970. That was my last amphetamine. Now, I didn't quit taking amphetamine because I felt I was powerless over it. I quit taking amphetamine because I got tired of the consequences. I got tired of people blowing smoke up my butt. But powerless? No, I never even considered I was powerless. I just got tired of the consequences. It's going to be an entirely different story 8 years later when I quit drinking. I had not talked about drinking because I did not drink at that time. Oh, occasional beer, but it wasn't an issue. Amphetamine was the drug of choice. Once I quit amphetamine, I had all those same feelings that we have, you know, and I started drinking. First 4 years of my drinking was not alcoholic. I might get drunk. I might stay sober. It wasn't an issue. Never thought about it much one way or another. Next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. Every day I thought about alcohol. I might not get drunk as often, but I knew exactly what I could drink, exactly when I could drink it, exactly what it would do. I would go to work at 8 in the morning looking forward to 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the ritual was the same. I'd go across the street, get me a quart of beer, drink that quart of beer till I got home, then get into some serious drinking with scotch, and then be drunk. That was the 3 years of alcoholic drinking. And then the last year, my drinking was addictive drinking because I drank a quart of whiskey a night. And I told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And I could believe it. I had to believe it. The peculiar mental twist was I had to believe it. I pissed my wife off enough in 1975 that she kicked me out. It took her that long. She was really as sick as I was, only she didn't have alcoholism. But she certainly was as sick as I was. And finally, I did like I always do. You know, I piss people off enough till they throw me out. And then I say, it's your problem if you didn't throw me out. You know, you're the one getting rid of me. Why are you pissed off? You know? But I did everybody that way. And finally, she kicked me out. And I womanized and drank whiskey and ran the streets and did all those things and ran into Casey. Casey's my wife, one of the dearest people I've ever known in my life. And hear that part of my story because you'll see what the peculiar mental twist and self-centeredness can do to a relationship. But she was actually the most wonderful person I'd ever met. We started living together almost immediately. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and December the 1st of 1977, Casey had gone off to work. And I was sitting in this easy chair looking out at the sun. I never went to bed, and I had this peculiar thought that if I never went to bed, the next day would never start. And it seemed like that if the day didn't start, I didn't get into as much trouble. So I got this feeling, if I just don't go to bed, it won't start. And I'd sit there and drink that quart of whiskey, and I'd put Neil Diamond's I Am, I Cry, thing, and I'd play that for an hour. I'd put in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and I'd play that all night long. Sit there and drink that whiskey, and Casey had gone off to work, and I was looking at that, and I'd had it all. I'd had it all. You know, I tried to quit drinking because I knew if I didn't quit drinking, I'd run her off like I'd run everybody else off. I tried scotch and water as my drink of choice. I tried to switch to beer, and all that did was make me pee and bloat. I switched to wine. It just made me sick. One night, I drank 24 martinis and couldn't get drunk. Next day, I drank one bottle of beer and couldn't walk for 3 days. You know, that's alcoholism. And I'm sitting there, and I thought, well, I can't drink. I can't take amphetamine, so I know what I'll do. I'll smoke dope. And I thought, well, for reasons you don't understand, none of this stuff works in you. None of this stuff works in you. And I thought, well, then I won't do anything. And I thought, you don't know how not to do anything. For over 20 years, you've done something on a daily basis almost. And you don't know how to live without something in you. And I reached the point to where, as the book says, I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. Totally helpless and totally hopeless. I said, God, you got to help me. What do you want me to do? And this gets very personal. And not everybody really hears what I'm going to say. And it isn't really necessary because I know. I know in my soul. I know in my guts. When I said that prayer, I became aware of what I had to do. And the peace that came over me was absolutely measurable. I went back to my bedroom, got my double barrel shotgun, and put it in my mouth because I was ready to die. That was the only way I knew how to stop it. And the idea of dying brought me great peace. The idea of living brought me stark terror. I did not know how to live, and I really wasn't afraid of dying. And I know, as well as I know my name, that every alcoholic will be brought to that moment of truth, that moment of clarity where we decide, do we want to live or do we want to die? And my God brought that moment in my life with amazing clarity. I had a choice. I had a choice. The beautiful part about it is that my God gives me the freedom to go wherever I want to go. And if I choose to die, He will cry. My God will cry. If I choose to come home, He's given me every tool I need to get back. Every tool I need to get back. What a wonderful, wonderful God to love us enough to let us go and give us every tool we need to bring us home. Every tool we need to bring us home. I became aware of a burning desire to live. I'm absolutely convinced today it was because of the dignity that I had in my home. My mother was goofy, but she loved me. My daddy loved me, and they gave me a sense of dignity. When I was a little boy rocking in that swing in the Sunday school kindergarten, they'd sing, God is love. God is love. And I came to know that God is love. And that dignity was what kept me from blowing out the back of my head. I didn't want my children to know their daddy died that way. I did not want Casey to come home and see me that way. That dignity. Let me tell you, if there's one word synonymous with recovery for this drunk, it's the return of dignity. It's the return of, for those people who've never lost it, they really don't know why we get together and have this kind of joy. It's because of the return of dignity. If you're with us and you haven't experienced it and you really want it, stay with us. Hook onto our coattails. Find the winners. And the dignity will come. Sooner or later, it will come. The return of dignity. The joy of dignity. Call and ask for help. Went over to see a psychiatrist who's a good friend of mine. Went in his office and I said, David, I need help. He said, Burns, you're going to have to go in the hospital. I remember looking at Our Lady of Peace. I said, David, I don't want to go in there. That place doesn't help me. But here it came. I said, I will do anything you tell me to do. I didn't negotiate. I didn't try to bitch, piss, and moan. I said, just tell me what to do. He said, well, you're not going to that hospital. I said, where am I going? He said, I don't know where you're going. 3 days later, he sent me to a hospital in New York called Payne Whitney Clinic, which made one flew over the cuckoo's nest look like a walk through Central Park. And he sent me there because as I sat there and talked with David, I looked at David and he said, Burns, what's wrong with you? And I said, I'm depressed. He said, well, hell, I know you're depressed. He said, I think it's because you drink too much. And I said, no, you don't understand. I drink too much because I'm depressed. And he said, no, you're depressed because you drink too much. I said, no, David, I'm depressed and therefore I drink. You know, 100% of people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous are depressed. 60% will clear in the first 3 weeks. 90% will clear within the first 6 months. 92% will clear within the first year. Only 8% will need medication. Only 8% will have a dual diagnosis. I'm absolutely convinced as one of the nation's top specialists in this field that you don't even make a dual diagnosis in this program for less than 2 years unless there's a complete psychotic break. Now let me tell you, I consider major vegetative depression a psychotic break. And there are people who need medication during that time. I believe in a complete drug-free recovery, but my message is all of us are depressed and 92% of us will clear, and that depression is due to the toxicity of the drug and also to the toxicity of the thinking, which takes a significant period of time to clear up enough so we can make sense out of cucumbers and peas, you know? When I got to Payne Whitney Clinic, he sent me there. He said, I want to scare the hell out of you. That's exactly what he told me in later years. He said, I would send you there. And he did it. I mean, I got in there and I found out these people were perverts. They didn't believe in detox. They gave me vitamins. And they also put me in a maximum security thing, gave me a plastic plate and plastic knife and fork, and they gave me a little split in the wall, and I'd stick that plastic plate through there, and they'd fill it up with food, and I'd bring it out, and they always gave me peas. And they gave me a fork, and I figured out that these perverts were watching, and the deal on going home was when I could get all the peas on the fork, they'd let me out. And I'd sit there, and I'd try to get those. Finally, I couldn't dare get them up that way, so I put them on one at a time. And then I had the next deal was how to get that fork to my mouth, you know. And finally, I realized if I just get down there and jump on it, that I'd get those peas. And once I could do that, after about 4 days, they did let me out, and they sent me to another room. After about 8 days in there, I go into to get my roommate to go play ping pong, and he's not around, so I open the door, and he's hanging in the closet. And I sit back and sat on the foot of the bed, and I looked at him, and my thought was, well, who will I get to play ping pong with? And I remember sitting there thinking, that's not an appropriate thought. I'm very serious. I thought, that's what I thought, and then I thought, that's not an appropriate thought. And I dropped on my knees. I said, God, what's the deal? I said, they're not calling me doctor around here. I'm on the inside. I'm not auditing this course. I'm one of the inside people, you know? What's my problem? And it hit me, whop, you're an alcoholic. And I thought, thank God, because my options look real slim about that. So I called Davey. He sent me to Atlanta, put me in an alcohol treatment center. I stayed for 28 days, got into a residential program, lived in a halfway house for approximately a month and a half. 2 months and came home. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I asked you, I said, what have I got to do to stay sober and be happy? And you said, do anything we tell you to do, you're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. I said, what have I got to do? And you said, don't drink. Now, for you newcomers, listen, this is the profundity of this program. Don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. I thought, okay, I'll do it. And I said, all they do is talk about don't drink. Hell, everywhere you go, don't drink. They just beat that damn thing to don't drink. And I thought, what's all this about? And I flipped out a tape of Sandy Beach. He said, every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. I thought, my God, the man's a genius. He's got the whole damn thing figured out. Go to meetings. So I was fine. I went to meetings. Let me tell you what I found out in meetings. I found out a whole series of things. One is I found out this is a perfect program composed of a lot of imperfect people. When I first came in the program, there were people wanting to take my wife to bed, and I understood that because she was real cute. People wanted to take me to bed, and that really bewildered me. Because, I mean, it really did. I'm serious. I had this bloated face, little bitty arms, little bitty legs, liver on my iliac crest. I mean, I was a mess. I didn't even want to sleep with me. Why would anybody else want to sleep with me? Even my right hand said, "Are you kidding me?" I ain't never said that before. I don't know anybody. I suppose for the newcomer, it's tough to know that was a spiritual moment, right? The damn man, I don't think I'd have told that, right? What I found out is, and there'd be people that would want to borrow money and they did and didn't intend to pay it back and they didn't. Then I began to wonder, what's this all about? If this is a place where recovery is supposed to be, what's this all about? So I would ask people why they wanted to take me out to have coffee, and the winners would say, because we want to stay sober and we want to help you stay sober. And I found the winners, the people with the lights on in their eyes. If you come in here and you get a hold of some of us who are just squirrelier than others and goofy as hell at this point in time, too self-centered to know what we're doing to you, then look for one of us who's a winner and hook onto our belt and come with us. Spirit, principles over personalities, absolutely Wilson knew what he was talking about. God put us all together, and boy, I'll tell you, when we get here, we're just goofier than goats. And during that period of time, judgment's impaired, and self-centeredness reigns supreme, and we'll walk all over everybody. I mean, in a heartbeat, never even know it, because that's the way it's always been. That's a peculiar mental twist, and we're just trying to figure out where in the hell the parking lot is, you know, and so we just have to figure it out. Next thing I found out is them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens, them that don't go to meetings. I found out that I always go to a meeting, hear something I'm supposed to hear. Sometimes I walk out of a meeting and I think, what the hell was I supposed to hear? I'm just pissed off at that guy, and I'm walking to the car, I hear God's voice say, I'll tell you what this meeting's all about. Go home. It's in the 5th chapter, 4 steps called a resentment. You better get rid of it. You liable to get drunk, boy. Yeah. Also found out when I read this book, said there will come a day and we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. What it means is we forget our last drink. We forget it. Thank God we've got a program that allows us to gently remember what we are. Every time I walk in that door, I'm reminded of what I am. You've helped teach me who I am. And if I forget what I am, I'll lose who I am, and you can take that to the bank. And each time I walk in a meeting, I'm gently reminded of what I am. I used to pray for God to give me a burning bush. He sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the glow in this room is so absolutely brilliant that I love it. The glow in this room is real, all burning bushes. Finally, I found out I go to a lot of meetings because I want to hear you tell me what you do in the 23 hours you're not in the meeting and live that day, because that's where I find out what living's all about. You take me to that book and you teach me those principles and you show me how you walk with them, and that's how I learn. That's how I learn. And I go to a lot of meetings because that's where my friends are. This is my home and I would not choose to be anywhere else. Don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. I got the big book down, I started reading, I think, God, that's beautiful, and I closed and couldn't remember it. I'd open it and I'd start reading it and I'd close and I couldn't remember it. I'd open my meditation book and read it and close it, couldn't. I'd open the Courage Journal paper and read it and close it and couldn't remember it. I'd come to Amy and I said, I can't remember anything. He'd say, hell, don't worry about it, none of us can. I said, how long does that last? About 6 months, 2 years. They go, well, yeah, it goes away. I come in the next night and say, I can't remember anything because I forgot what you told me the night before, you know. I used to lose my car drunk all the time. I lost my car sober for the first year I was in this program. I used to drive my car to the office and go in practice medicine, come out, get in the car, drive it home, drive it in, practice medicine, get in the car and drive it and go home. One day I drove my wife's car, parked it, went in, practiced, came out and looked around, couldn't find my car and started crying. I cried a lot in that first year of sobriety. I really did. Walked back in, got my partner, and I said, Dave, somebody stole my car. And he came out, looked around, and he said, Burns, you drove Casey's car. And I said, oh, that's right, I forgot. Hell, my partners, and but by this time I had 5 or 6 partners, and they assigned me a parking space. And they said, when Burns leaves the office, he's going to that parking space. If he gets whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home. Hell, I came home and I went to church. I went to see a psychiatrist. I started going to AA. I got a spiritual advisor. I got a sponsor. I mean, if you'd told me to eat a bucket of crap, I would have done it. Anything to do to stay sober. And this was in the late 70s, and they didn't know this prolonged recovery syndrome. Let me tell you what the prolonged recovery syndrome, medical science studied us in 1975, defined it in 1979. Bill Wilson knew it in 1937. You know, and it says the alcoholic will lose the power of retentive memory for recent events for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving and stress management will disappear for 6 months to 2 years. Sleep patterns will be destroyed. I used to come and say, I can't sleep. And you'd say, nobody ever died from lack of sleep. I don't know. They don't. But the fact is, that's true. That is absolutely true. I went to see this psychiatrist. He didn't know this prolonged recovery syndrome. He put me in intensive cognitive therapy right out of treatment center. I'd go in on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I'd finish on Tuesdays, come back on Thursdays, and Homer, I'd say, Homer, where do you want to start? And he'd say, pick up where you were on Tuesday. And I'd say, I can't remember where I was on Tuesday. He'd say, you're trying to block your therapy. And I'd go, God, I'm a worm. I'm blocking my therapy. And after about 6 months of that, I finally said, I got to leave, Homer. I don't know what the deal is, but there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. You know what the message is? Keep it simple. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. That first year when I came home from treatment, I was so bewildered and so confused. I'd call my sponsor in the morning. Sometimes six, seven times a day, I'd walk into the examining room, see a patient, be fine, white coat, stethoscope, looking good, Dr. Brady. Walk out in the hall, stand there, just like that. Walk in, pick up the phone, and I'd call Jim, and I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he'd say, Burns, did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Get the office on time? Yeah. You seeing your patients? Yeah. Did you eat your lunch? Going to. Coming home to a meeting this evening? Yeah. You'll be okay. I'd hang up and I'd feel better. 30 minutes later, I'd pick up the phone and I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. He'd say, did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Keep it simple. You can't feed steak to people who are not capable of eating mashed potatoes. You know why that book is... You know why that... You know why that book is so simple? That book is so simple for drunks like me. Drunks like me. You know the people who have the easiest time in this program? They are people with a 50 IQ who've never been to church. They have an easy time with this program. You take us pseudo-rocket scientists like me, it takes us a hell of a long time to figure it out, you know? But they wrote it real simple because that's really all we're capable of dealing with is in simple terms, simple sentences, and beautiful principles. That's what it's all about. I thought, well, if I don't drink, I can't read the big book. By God, it's not going to work. Now I thought, how does it work? And I flipped open where it said how it works. I was getting better. We read how it works, and there it was. First paragraph. There it was. Three times. Honesty. 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 Anybody can make it if they can be honest. That's the deal. I'll tell you, for the hundreds of people I've worked with, the ones who don't make it are the ones who cannot be honest. When I walked into treatment, I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night and begged to go to treatment. Sat in front of the guy running the treatment center, he looked at me and said, Burns, how much do you drink? I said, I drink a six-pack of beer every night. He said, you're lying. I said, I know it. I do it all the time. Why not do it? I'd play golf and hit my ball on the green and go up there and I'd put a dime in the front of the ball. And I'd come back and put my ball in front of the dime. This was summer before I went to treatment. I just saved myself a quarter of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I hated my gut. When I came back from treatment, I'd hit that ball on that green eventually, and I'd go up there and I'd put the dime in front of the ball, and I'd come back and put that ball behind that dime, and I'd walk off of that green feeling good about me. Couldn't count to six, but I felt good about it. They'd say, you ask Burns Brady anything, he'll tell you the truth. May not have a thing to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth. I've had people today say, that's cash register honesty. You bet your ass it is, and it's as important to me today as the day I walked in these doors is cash register honesty. Never belittle cash register honesty. The peculiar mental twist will allow me to pervert cash register honesty. And every time I do, there's a piece inside me that just turns to decay and rot. And eventually I begin to believe what I'm thinking, and the peculiar mental twist has me. Being honest one day at a time is essential. Being honest one day at a time is essential. When I know I'm lying, I can tell you half truths or half the truth, but I know it, and it guts me. It just guts me. And I don't care if you've been sober 24 hours or 24 years. It's the same damn deal. I'm going to tell you, it's the same deal. And I'm going to tell you with a peculiar mental twist. And the last time I really made the last fling, my wife at 8.5 years decided to go into therapy, do some other stuff. And this nurse I'd had for 2.5 years had taken care of me during that time. And she needed some counseling because of the divorce she was going through. And it took me 6 months to be turning the key in the Holiday Inn where the counseling had started, just talking to her about why she and her husband were breaking up. And as I turned that key, I thought, dear God, I don't want to get drunk, and just started screaming. But I'd come to believe it, and I was bullshitting myself right down the line. People say, well, you got to be honest with yourself. There's a hooker in that for me. Besides the peculiar mental twist, it says in the 10-step, alcohol is subtle. Alcohol is subtle. See, I really know alcohol is subtle. It can have me believe the lie, the peculiar mental twist. It takes every bit of it, a sponsor, spiritual director, a home group, 5 meetings a week, all of it to deal with that subtlety of alcoholism. Some of my greatest moments of subtlety and perversion have been in prayer, where I believed the isolated prayer. Prayer has given me some of the greatest directions and some of the greatest sideways perversions I've ever had. Isolated prayer. I've come to know prayer and share, prayer and share, prayer and share, share the prayer. Share the prayer. Finally, on the last thing about the Big Book, people say, well, I listened to Burns Brady talk, and he didn't study the Big Book for 8.5 years. Let me tell you something. I don't want anybody to ever leave a talk I've ever given that didn't realize that if you want it, it's in the book. The steps are in the book, but there are other parts of the book that develop those steps. I've heard people say, well, you can't do a 4-step for at least a year in the program. That's baloney. I now work 3 days a week in a men's homeless shelter. We sleep 200 men a night. We've got 75 of them in a 4.5-month Big Book study. Those guys are coming in off of the streets and are in their 4th step within the first 2 weeks. Now, it won't be the last 4th step they'll take. And if you listen to people tell you, and this may work for them, that after you do the first 9 steps, then the other 3 are the maintenance steps. You don't have to do those first 9 again. That ain't the way it's worked for me. We got these men off of these streets in the middle of a 4-step at 3 weeks. And I'm watching miracles happen. Yeah, I've worked with probably 500 doctors. And you expect that to work in them because they got a lot to lose. It's working in the street people because they found out from us they got a lot to gain. And they're working in that 4-step. So don't tell me you wait a year. Don't tell me if you're on the 2nd step and can't get it, go back to the 1st. Go to the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th and the 6th. Let that spiritual awakening occur as the result of these steps. Don't sit there and mentally play with yourself trying to figure out why you didn't get the 1 step before. You know? And this is born out of having to bury too many drunks who took a step back rather than a step forward. And I promise my God, if my experience meant anything, I'd never let that ever happen again. First year was crazy. Called my sponsor a lot. 2nd year started clear up. And the 3rd year, I became little Mr. Perfect AA. Get up on time, read your meditation, eat your breakfast, get to the office, call your sponsor, call your wife, eat your lunch, call your sponsor, call your wife, get home in the evenings, get to the meeting 30 minutes early, set up the ashtray, set up the coffee, greet the newcomer, give him your telephone number, talk in the meeting, stay 30 minutes late, talk to the newcomer, get home in the evening, talk to your wife, say your prayers, make love with your wife, call your sponsor, go to bed, boom, 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 little Mr. Perfect AA, right? At 5 years in this program, the old timers come up to me and say, how are you doing, Burns? I say, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. I was down in South Georgia visiting my first spiritual director, an Episcopal priest, and we were at the Holiday Inn, and I got at his home, came back Holiday Inn, I dropped on my knees, and I said, God, take away the pain. Casey put her hands on my shoulder and said, call your sponsor. My first sponsor had a two-step program. That's not a judgment. That's just a report. And because I want you to hear what he said. And I called him. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. He said, you're the most compliant person I've ever known. I said, Jim, will I ever get it? He said, Burns, I don't know. When you get home, we'll talk about it. I started to hang up. He said, let me ask you something. I said, what? And he said, do you believe if you work these steps perfectly, it'll make you good? I said, yes. He said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad? And I said, yes. He said, Burns, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it. He said, you can't earn it, and you can't kick it away. If you want to feel good about yourself, you're going to have to work these steps, and you're going to have to try not to take a drink today, but God's going to love you drunk, sober, in the wrong bed, wherever it's going to be. See, this was something I needed desperately, and my life changed. I came to know a God who loves me just as I am. Spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection became a way of life for me at 5 years in this program. I don't know whether it takes that long for some people, whether it takes longer for others. It may not even come that way to people, some people, but it came to me, and I know my God loved me. I really didn't know the parable of the prodigal son was not the story of the drunk who comes home. It's that. Or the brother who resents. It's that. But for me, it was a story of the father who waits. And will always be here if I stick out my hand and take his hand and walk with him and walk with you, who are his messengers. You are my God with skin on him. And when I reach out, you've always been there. The next 3 years, God was preparing me to deal with the next issue of what I call hostage taking. All alcoholics take hostages. The therapists call it codependency. Not all codependents are alcoholic, but I'm going to tell you, all alcoholics are codependent. And I know what I mean by that term for me. I know exactly what I mean because I've taken hostages all my life. And you know what the prerequisite was? Take care of me and make me feel special. And I picked everybody in my life to take care of me and make me feel special. I picked a sponsor who did that. Finally, he got goofy as hell. And I had to get a new sponsor. My first wife was that way. And when I picked Casey, she was that way. And God knew it was time for me to go on. God knew it was time for me to go on, and he knew that I couldn't stay in that spot. When the student's ready, the teacher will arrive. Casey came to me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and she said, Burns, I need to go into treatment. I want to start going to my own AA meetings, and I want to go back to school. And see, I had Casey on my hip. Had Casey right here on my hip. You know, like most alcoholics, I mean, I was a benevolent dictator. Everywhere I went, I'd take her. We'd pray together. We'd make love together. We would go up to the Bahamas together. We would go to meetings together. We'd say the third step prayer together right here on my hip at all times. And finally, she was going to move away from me. And I started to look for another one who would take care of me and make me feel special. About that time, a little pigeon of mine with 7 months of sobriety came and gave me Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I listened to them. I knew the program that I didn't have. We had copies made, and 12 of us started studying those steps about 8 years ago. And my whole life changed. I found out my purpose in being here. And I began to be a support for my wife. I began to encourage her to go to school. I began to encourage her to do the things she wanted to do in her life. And 3 years ago, my wife graduated from college, number one in her class. And about a year ago, in April, I had a heart attack. I almost died. They put me in some therapy for what they call post-traumatic stress syndrome after that was over. And in that therapist was a woman who was very nurturing to me, much like my mother. And it was wonderful. After about 2 to 3 months of that, I began to realize that Casey and I had some problems. They'd been caused almost entirely by me that had not been resolved. We both had beautiful spiritual programs, but I had screwed up the communication, and we went into marriage counseling together, and our marriage has healed incredibly in the past 4 months. And I'll tell you, it was gut-busting for me. That's when I came to realize that I'd always said, take care of me and make me feel special. Something else I realized is I didn't believe I could take care of myself. 58 years old, and I didn't think I could take care of myself. And I got to a whole different level with my God. And the last plateau of surrender is I really have come in contact with, am deeply appreciative of, and feel deep in my guts that God is everything. It tells us that there will come a day we'll have to say, God is everything or He's nothing. He is or He is not. And the ultimate surrender. It has not been easy for me. It's taken every bit of your help. It's taken every bit of this program. And for the first time in my whole life, I feel free. It's incredible. I'll tell you two stories, or three stories, and I'll quit. You've been very patient, and I appreciate very much that you have been. First, I don't know if these miracles will occur in your life. I will promise you that miracles will occur if you stick around this program. The first has to do with my daughter. 18 years ago, my daughter sat straddling my chest. I was passed out drunk. I'd gone over to babysit for the children. Her mother had to go in the hospital. She was strung out on Valium, Darvon, and alcohol. She tried to kill me. The reason she didn't was because she tried to shoot me with an automatic shotgun and she didn't know how to load it. She really didn't. She came into Alcoholics Anonymous 12 years ago. And 5 years ago, she got married, and guess who she asked to give her away? Daddy. A year ago, she got a divorce. And she came and sat and talked with me on every day about the divorce and the spiritual path that both she and her husband, who was in AA, was following. And it was one of those divorces where there was a lot of sadness, but it was something that needed to be done. It was done with the dignity of the spirituality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came and talked with me. She came and sat and talked with me. The same person she tried to kill 18 years ago. My son came in AA 10 years ago, or maybe it's 11 now. He'd lived with me and Casey from age 11 to age 14. He's told me since then that he started to drink about age 14. He knew I'd catch him, so he went to live with his mother. He stole all of his mother's jewelry, and they've allowed me to tell this story. He told all of his mother's stole all of his mother's jewelry, sold it piece by piece, and she didn't say anything. He stole all of her silverware and sold it piece by piece, and she didn't say anything. Finally, he stole her car, and she had to say something. She left him in jail for 3 days, and when he got out, she said, "You can't live here." And he came to talk to me, and I knew he'd be coming. For a year, I knew he would be coming. For a year, I'd worked with my sponsor and my spiritual director and worked these steps to be able to say to my son what I would have to say that would be right for him. Literally in his best interest, to be of maximum service. And I knew what I'd have to say. God, I wasn't sure I wanted to say it, but I knew it had to be said because I knew he had this fatal malady and he was going to die. He said, "Daddy, I'd like to come live with you and Casey." And I said, "Burns, if you want to go into treatment, we'll talk about it." He said, "Treatment for what?" And I said, "Treatment for your alcoholism." He said, "I'm not an alcoholic." I said, "If you want to live on the streets, that's your call. If you want to live with me and Casey, that's my call. You go to treatment or you're on the streets." He said, "Screw you." Turned around and walked out, and I dropped on my knees. And it took a year to do this. Now, please understand, this was not a heroic act. This was an absolute spiritual act that took me a year to be prepared to live with the consequences. Every day I knew where that boy was, and I knew God would help me to know what to do. Finally, after 4 months, he came back to me, and he said, "Daddy, please get me some help." Put him into treatment. He came home, and about a year later, we were in a meeting. A woman raised her hand. She said, "My son went off to camp with two other boys. They've been smoking dope. They didn't catch my son, but I know he's smoking dope. What can I do to help him?" A bunch of us talked. Finally, my son raised his hand. He said, "I don't know what you can do to help him, but I'll tell you what turned my life around." He said, "My sister was somebody I've always loved, but she got on the streets and used dope and drugs, and she was somebody I didn't respect. She got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and she became a lady." But he said, "What turned my life around was my daddy." He said, "When he lived at home with us and with Mama, said he'd come in drunk, and he'd slap Mother around. He'd come up and whip us if we weren't in bed." He said, "Mother kicked him out of the house, and then he'd call and say, 'I'm going to come over and pick y'all up,' and say he'd never come." He said, "Sometimes he'd be 3 or 4 days late, and sometimes he just never came at all." He said, "Then Daddy got into Alcoholics Anonymous. He came back and told Mama he was sorry and paid her money that he owed her. And then when he told Sissy and me he was coming, he was always there when he said he'd be there. And when I was out there on those streets, I knew I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy." Be careful how you walk and talk. You may be the only big book that somebody will ever read. Final story has to do with my daddy. My mother died in 1978 of breast cancer. I was blessed to have 8 months of sobriety, and every weekend I went down and talked to Mama, and we never had a problem. I made my amends to her, and we hugged, and she died, and it was over. The headstone. What a hell of a story. The headstone. My daddy was a neat man. Within 2 years, he married again to a really lovely lady. My mother was easy to talk to. She would talk about my alcoholism, and she would accept my amends. I'd go see Daddy and want to tell him I was sorry, and he said, "I don't want to talk about it, Burns Mac. I don't want to talk about it." My daddy was a wonderful man. He never said much. He never said, "I loved you." But he was always there. I broke my leg playing football, and he was the first one to put me on a stretcher. Broke it playing basketball. Broke it playing baseball. had a neat daddy, bad legs, you know. And he was always be the one there to put me on the stretcher. But he never say, "I love you." He never let me make my amends. Each time I'd go make them, finally you told me, "Quit trying to cram your amends down your daddy's throat. Recognize he has his face. That's not right. Don't try to alleviate your own guilt and shame by shoving it down your daddy's throat." But I wanted Daddy to tell me he loved me and tell it was okay. And I've worked with hundreds of men, and every man I've ever worked with wanted that daddy or that significant male to say it's okay. There'll come a time in this program where it isn't essential, but every one of us want it. I don't work with women, and for reasons that are very personal. I'd love to, but it's just not in mine or their best interest. It's just not mine or their best interest. But I've worked with hundreds of men, and I recognize that's exactly what they want. And that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted. Daddy started to lose his mind about 5 years ago. Not Alzheimer's. It looks like it, but it's arteriosclerotic cerebrovascular disease, hardening of the arteries in the brain. Little by little, he forgot who I was, and he even forgot who Mother was. He thought I was his brother, my Uncle Buster. We had to put Daddy in a nursing home. Peggy and I talked about it, my stepmother at great length, and finally put Daddy in a nursing home. This was about 2.5 years ago, and I'd drive down every weekend, park the car all the way down. I'd say, "God, take away my pain. Please, God, take away my pain." I'd go in and talk to Daddy, get in the car, and cry all the way back, 250-mile drive. Finally, one Sunday, I drove up and I parked this car and I said, "Dear God, let me today be for my daddy what you want me to be." And I walked in. He was sitting in a wheelchair. He was so weak he couldn't walk. I didn't call him daddy. That confused him. I said, "Hal, would you like me to shave you?" He said, "Buster, I believe I would." So I shaved him. I said, "Are you hungry?" And he said, "I believe I am." I said, "Let me take you in there and get you some food." So I rolled him in the dining room. He's too weak to eat, and I got his food, and I fed him. Got through feeding him. He was sitting in the wheelchair, and Peggy came in, and she sat there, and she and I got to talking. Mom and I had done this for years. Daddy would always sit and watch Mom and me talk. Mama liked to talk, and as you well know, I like to talk. We'd sit there, and we'd talk, and Daddy would just watch. Turned around and looked at him, and I said, "Hal, would you like to go out on the porch?" And he said, "Buster, I believe I would." And I rolled him out on the porch and set him there. And we were looking out. Son, Peggy came in, sat down. Peggy and I were talking. We were talking. Daddy just sitting there watching us. And finally he raised up in his chair and he looked me right in the face. He said, "Son, today you're just like the little boy your mom and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me." The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that this self-centered alcoholic sat in that parking lot and said, "Let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." That's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart. We feel without touching. We hear without talking. We love by instinct. For the next few moments in this room, as I quit talking, take the hand of the person next to you or just sit quietly, but share with me the power of Alcoholics Anonymous in this room, the language of the heart. I close every talk that I've ever given the same way. When I couldn't walk, talk, and chew gum, I used to listen to tapes, and Father Martin had a tape, The 12 Steps, and he closed that tape in a way which says exactly what I want to say to you. You people will be in my thoughts frequently. You will be in my heart, and you will be in my prayers always. I love you from the very bottom of my heart. I thank you for loving me. I thank you for asking me to come to talk. But most of all, I thank you and people like you all over this country who have delivered to me and mine the message that gave us our God and our lives. for those people that I have seen, that I've known before, it's good to see you. For those people that I've met new, thank you. For those people I didn't get to meet, we will meet as we trudge this road of happy destiny. Until that day, Godspeed and good night.